Our scripture text this evening is from 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8. Let me remind you of the situation. Israel has been governed by judges for many centuries, and now it is experiencing a time of transition to the monarchy. The people are growing weary of being judged and governed by judges who administer the law of God. They want to keep up with the Canaanite Joneses and have a king and a government like all the other nations of the world. Now that's the context. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 4. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah, and they said to him, "Behold, you've grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations." Let me stop and say that there would have been nothing wrong with them desiring a king, because in Deuteronomy 16 and 17, God made provisions for a king centuries before this particular situation. The issue was that they wanted a king like all the other nations, and not a king like Jehovah. But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they've rejected me, says the Lord, from being king over them. Like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them up from Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forgotten me and served other gods, so they're doing it to you also. Now then, listen to their voice. However, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure or the program of the king who will reign over them." So Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked of him a king. And he said, "This will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and place them for himself in his chariots and among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and of fifties, and some to do his plowing and to reap his harvest, and to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will also take your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. And he will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. And he will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. He will also take your male servants and your female servants and your best young men and your donkeys and use them for his work. He will take a tenth of your flock, and you yourselves will become his servants. Then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourself. But the Lord will not answer you in that day." Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, "No, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." Now, after Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the Lord's hearing. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to their voice and appoint them a king." So Samuel said to the men of Israel, "Go every man to his city." Here's a sad situation in the life of Israel. They were not satisfied with theocratic government. They weren't satisfied with a government that based everything that it did on the law of God, even though it was the freest government on earth. They were embarrassed at their outmoded, obsolete, old-fashioned religious establishment, and they wanted a secular, strong, tyrannical king like the rest of the nations. Samuel didn't want it. Godly man that he was, lover of freedom and of law and order that he was, he wanted to maintain the Christian Republic of the Hebrews. But God said, "No, they're not turning against you, Samuel. Ultimately, they're turning against me. Let them have what they want. Coronate their king. And they'll see what life is like under the government of man rather than under the government of God. You tell them what that type of government's like, Samuel. You tell them what it's like living under a tyrant who does not believe and will not obey and enforce biblical law." And then he describes a situation that you'd have thought that he'd been in America for the past decade. Because he says here that this tyrant, who will not neither obey nor enforce biblical law, will be a militarist. He'll have a large standing army. He'll use that army. He'll draft all of your young men in his army, and he'll use that army in all kinds of wars for political purpose. And they'll shed their blood, not for liberty and honor and justice, but for the political goals and whims of that tyrant. Moreover, it says he will nationalize agriculture and all forms of industry. He will place farms, commerce, industry, the whole economy of the nation's life under his authority to serve his purposes. He will make your children and your servants his slaves, and he will really show what a tyrant he is by taxing you a tenth of your income. Oh, that we had tyrants like that today. God judged Israel because they had a king that taxed them a tenth of their income. What does that say about our present federal government? And so it says here also that there will be a massive bureaucracy that will drain all the wealth and the freedom of Israel. And Israel will cry out, and God will not answer until they realize that it's better living under the sovereignty of God than under the tyranny of man. 1660. England said, "We want a king like the other nations. We're not satisfied with the theocratic rule of the Lord Protector, Oliver Cromwell. We don't want a Christian republic based upon biblical law. We want a king like the other nations." And so, 1660, we talked last week, the restoration of the monarchy took place. Charles II came back to the throne, one of the family of the Stuarts, known for their bigotry and their love for tyranny. Last week, we left James II dead. And now we will commence Charles II dead, and we'll begin this evening with James II, his brother. Charles II ruled as a tyrant from 1660 to 1685. He died, and his 53-year-old brother, James Stuart II, comes to the throne, and praise God, he only reigned till 1688. We have the continuation of the restoration of the monarchy, and understand that the restoration of the Stuart monarchy was basically a repudiation of the ideals and goals and biblical principles of the Puritan Commonwealth. The ultimate aim of the restored Stuart monarchy was twofold. Number one, to regain and hold absolute authority as king over church and state. And number two, to reconvert England into a Roman Catholic nation again, and to put England back under the power of the Pope. Those were the two great goals of the restored Stuart monarchy, starting in 1660 and going until 1688. The reestablishment of absolute control on the part of the king over every area of life, and the restoration of the Roman Catholic Church to England, the restoration of England to the Roman Catholic Church. Now let me tell you about James Stuart II, brother of Charles II. He was a bigot, he was vain, he was arrogant, and he was thoroughly immoral. He loved power and tyranny as much as his father and his grandfather. And his own personal behavior and conduct was no more restrained than his brother Charles's conduct had been. When James came to the throne at the age of 53, he was already physically weakened and sick because of his immorality and debauchery. Some have said that his particular form of arrogance and his blindness to the consequences of his actions were evidence of a premature mental decline connected with his immorality. There's very little you could say about James that's good. It seems as if he did not have one single taste, preference, gift, or interest beyond two things: his fanaticism in the restoration of the Roman Catholic Church, and his gross licentiousness. His 4-year reign brought the Stuart dynasty to disaster. He was married twice. He was first married to a woman who gave him 2 daughters. One daughter's name was Mary Stuart, who married the Dutch Calvinist Presbyterian William of Orange. His other daughter, Anne, married George of Denmark, and both of his daughters would be Protestant queens of England. He married a second time to a Roman Catholic woman by the name of Mary of Modena, and she bore him a son called James Francis Edward Stuart. Now, the question you might ask if you've been thinking about the situation and you remember the history of that century, how in the world did a Roman Catholic monarch come to the throne so easily and so calmly in Anglican England and Puritan England? In fact, the accession of an avowed papist to the throne of England was a flagrant breach of the English Constitution. How did it happen? Not only did this Roman Catholic come to the throne, but both the Parliament of England and the Parliament of Scotland vowed slavish, unqualified submission to his will without requiring him so much as a coronation oath to be faithful to his duties. What makes it more amazing is that a few months earlier, the House of Commons in England voted to exclude this very James from the throne of England because he was a Roman Catholic. And now he's the King of England. Why is that? Well, one reason, the most important reason, is that the Whig Party was shattered. Now, remember, this was the period in which political parties first began to be formed. You had the Tories, and by the way, the word Whigs and Tories, a Whig, I've forgotten, is either a Scottish outlaw or an Irish outlaw, and the word Tory is either an Irish outlaw or a Scottish outlaw. But those were the names of the two political parties. The Tories were in support of the crown. The Whigs, which included the Puritans and the others, wanted a weak central government, a strong republic. And their cause had been shattered by all kinds of divisions and rivalries and jealousies and factions. And it was very difficult for them to resist the ascension of this Roman Catholic king. Furthermore, this king promised that he would preserve the Christian government of the church and the state of England as it had been established. And he said, I'm not going to touch a thing. I'm not going to change anything. And besides that, remember, the Anglican clergy had always supported the tyranny of kings. Always supported. They supported the Stuarts, James I, Charles I, Charles II, and now, at least at the beginning of his reign, they support the tyranny of James II over both the church and the state. Remember, the King of England was not only the power over the civil affairs, but was the head of the church as well. At his coronation, you could see the handwriting on the wall for his future. At his coronation, when he was crowned king, all of the Anglican rites that are performed with the coronation of a king by the Archbishop of Canterbury took place, except for one thing. At the coronation of the kings in those days, they would take the Lord's Supper in a Church of England fashion. James II refused openly taking the Roman Catholic Mass, which was against the law. The newly elected Parliament were his supporters. Right at the very beginning of his reign, there was an attempt to overthrow it. There was an alliance between two men. One man was the great, staunch Scottish Presbyterian, the Earl of Argyle, A-R-G-Y-L-L-E. He made an alliance with a man named James Walters, Duke of Monmouth. James Walters, Duke of Monmouth, was the favorite illegitimate son of Charles by a woman named Lucy Walters when Charles was about 18 years of age. He was claiming now to be the King of England, not James II. He was the Duke of Monmouth. And so he gathered an army from the south to begin the rebellion. The Earl of Argyle, a Scottish Presbyterian, invaded England from the north in an attempt to break the back of the monarch and change the government. But this rebellion of Argyll and Monmouth was a dramatic failure. Those men were tried, arrested, found guilty, and executed. Their supporters in southern and western England particularly were brutally decimated at James's command. Whole villages were executed. Gangs of chained prisoners were marched through London on their way to slavery. And the savagery with which the courts punished the English peasants that supported this uprising shocked the whole nation. James then outraged the nation more, being worried about further uprising, so he kept a standing army in London around him of 20,000 soldiers. He sought to repeal the Habeas Corpus Act, which means you can't arrest anybody unless you have a legal reason to do so. He sought to do away with the Habeas Corpus Act. He also sought to do away with the Test Act, which was established during his brother Charles's time, which said that you had to be a member of the Church of England to hold public office, thereby excluding all Roman Catholics. When Parliament refused to go along with the King and do away with the Habeas Corpus and do away with the Test Act, what did he do but dismiss Parliament? He dominated the church and bullied the church by reestablishing the old court of high commission that was responsible for so many atrocities in earlier days. These rebellions of Argyll and Monmouth were failures. It's been said that the lack of success of these two rebellions, organized by Scottish and English Protestant heroes, was remarkable. The lack of success was remarkable. But the reason for their failure is this. Though Monmouth, who claimed to be the true heir of the throne, and the Presbyterian Argyll joined together to overthrow the tyranny of James II, they couldn't agree on their goals. Argyll wanted a theocratic republic. Monmouth wanted the throne. Their military movements and tactics and strategies were poorly planned. The people who were supposed to back them in London lost their nerves and backed out. And the whole rebellion was wrongly timed. James was still behaving as far as showing his true colors is concerned. He hadn't begun any fierce persecution of the Church of England. What was really amazing about these rebellions is how near they came to success. They almost overturned the throne of James II. Thousands of poor, simple, uneducated men joined this rebellion because they saw the tyranny and bigotry of the Stuart kings. But they were defeated. And some have said that this was the last flash, the last gap for breath of the old cause of 1642. What happened in 1642? In the 1640s, the writing of the Westminster Confession of the Faith, the calling of the separation institutionally of church and state, the calling for representative government under Cromwell, the destruction of tyranny, that they saw this rebellion of Argyll and Monmouth as the last dying gasp of that good old cause that goes all the way back to the fountainhead of Presbyterianism in the 1640s. But was it a last flash? Was it a last gasp for breath? Or was it a clear link between that movement that led to the execution of Charles I and then led to the total exile of James II? The Earl of Argyll's last Sunday on earth was a great day. He told his sister, he knew he was being executed, and he told his sister, quote, "I am now loosed from you and all earthly satisfactions, and I long to be with Christ, which is far better. It seems the Lord thought me not fit to be an instrument in his work, but I die in the faith of it, that it will advance. I hear they cannot agree about the manner of my death, but I am assured of my salvation, and as for my body, I care not what they do with it." A few hours before his execution, he was served a big meal, which eyewitnesses say he ate with great cheerfulness. And a couple hours before his death, as was his custom throughout all his life, he took a little nap after his meal. And for about an hour slept like a baby. And they woke him up and took him to the scaffolds. Now, what was the character of the reign of James II? From the very day that he was crowned king, when he refused to take Anglican communion and took Roman Catholic Mass, to the day in which he abdicated the throne, during which flight to France he took the great seal of England, the great seal of the monarchy, and threw it into the Thames River. From the beginning to the end of his reign, his whole administration was a medley of outrages on the Constitution and political blunders caused by one thing, his intense bigotry that blinded him to anything and everything else except the reestablishment of papal power over Great Britain. He was consistent in only one thing, and that is his blind fanaticism. He was fanatically determined to bring England back under the tyranny of the Pope, to the point that even the English bishops, who had always supported tyranny, resisted him, and he had to arrest and persecute them. From the beginning of his reign, he spared neither money nor effort to propagate the Roman Catholic faith in England. I remember it had been outlawed. Priests and monks were encouraged to return from the continent of Europe. Small religious houses were established in London. There was a first-class Jesuit school that was built that attracted Protestant students in considerable numbers. A Catholic press was set up and flooded the market with inexpensive works of devotion and proselyting people to the Roman faith. In fact, for the first time since 1558, there was formal diplomatic relations established with the Pope, and the Pope actually appointed a vicar apostle for the English Catholic Church. And James was arguing that he, as the head of the church, should start appointing all the bishops. Surely, they would have been Roman Catholic. And his tyranny increased as time went on. After the execution of Monmouth and Argyle, James felt secure in his crown. He felt he could get away with everything he wanted to do. So he hardened his heart and he went his own way. Parliament was voting him all the money that he needed because his friends were in power. European powers competed for his friendship. He had a strong army, a strong navy at his disposal. His Puritan enemies in England were largely dead or disarmed, and he was determined to revive the pristine glory of the divine right of kings. You remember that was the doctrine his daddy and his granddaddy and his great-granddaddy all loved. And that is that God has set them as kings over a land and they are above the law. Remember the great difference between the Puritans and the Stuarts. The Stuarts believed rex lex. The king is law. He's not just above the law, he is law. Whatever he says is law. The Puritans, on the other hand, argued, to use the title of Samuel Rutherford's great book, Lex Rex. The Stuart said, Rex Lex, the king is law. The Puritan said, Lex Rex, the law is king. And even human kings are accountable to that law. Well, he was determined to restore the old divine right of kings. He loved and admired Louis XIV. You go back in your Western Civ books and read about Louis XIV of France, the Sun King, you know, Versailles and all that. The Sun King, Louis XIV, great Roman Catholic tyrant. James was always courting him. And in fact, to show you what, there's a great Afrikaans word, to show you what a scullum he is, to show you what a good-for-nothing crook this guy was. James II was on the King of England, the head of the church, was on the payroll of Louis XIV. He was a paid spy for France on the English people. And when he fled England, he was put on a pension by Louis XIV. Well, he saw Louis XIV do something that put some thoughts in his mind. You remember the French Huguenots? The Huguenots were the French Calvinists. who fought for a free Reformed church in Roman Catholic France. But brutally and in bloody persecution, one Roman Catholic government in France after another would persecute the Huguenots, killing tens of thousands of them, butchering them. Well, finally, there was a document signed, an agreement signed, called the Edict of Nantes, N-A-N-T-E-S, the Edict of Nantes. And in that edict in France, the Huguenots were given freedom of worship. They could worship according to the Word of God without any threat from the government. Louis XIV revoked that edict and took away from the French Calvinists any freedom of worship and any freedom to participate in the political aspects of France. And persecution was revived. That made James II bold to be even more courageous and offensive in pushing for Catholic power against the Protestants in England. So he granted numerous commissions in his army to Roman Catholics in defiance of the law. It was against the law to have Roman Catholics as in commanding officers in the army. In his Privy Council, which is not quite a cabinet, but is his basic group of men that gave him advice and consent to his actions, whenever his Privy Council would oppose him, he would fire those who opposed them and replace them with Roman Catholics. Now in Puritan, now Anglican England, Protestant England, Parliament soon began to be fed up with James and became suspicious of him, and protested the people he was appointing to office. So what do you think James, the good steward that he was, did? Dismissed the Parliament. Throughout 1686, he promoted with fanatical enthusiasm Roman Catholics to key positions everywhere. Many Roman Catholics commanded the army. A Roman Catholic was put in charge of the entire navy. Another one became Lord Lieutenant of Ireland. Another was appointed Master of Ordnance. You know what ordnance is? It's ammunition. And an ecclesiastical commission was set up to silence Anglican critics, even removing from his office a bishop from London. But the king drove too fast and too furiously for Parliament. His methods were too extreme. His procedure to de-Protestantize England and bring it back under the power of the Pope was too blatant. His methods were too harsh and blunt. And so things got as far as they could go when, in 1687, there was a public reception of an official representative of the Pope into the court of the king. And the king's Jesuit advisor, Father Peter, was introduced into the Privy Council. This was simply a challenge to public opinion. And then he was stupid enough to force a Roman Catholic president on Oxford and Cambridge universities. And that was too much for the Tories to stand. He sought to smother all opposition by using his absolute authority. And in doing so, he alienated everybody. Not only the ruling aristocracy, but even the voteless, uneducated mobs of people. He tried to control the political machinery of local governments so that in the new parliament, he could control who was elected, and that that the counties would elect people to Parliament that would be supportive of his will. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? When I was running for Congress in North Georgia, there was a little old lady in her 80s that I talked to, a little Democrat lady, who had it in her will that when she died, she wanted to be buried in Chicago so she could continue to vote. Well, anyway, there's the same type of control, an attempted control now, upon the local political machinery in England to guarantee the right people, the supporters of James, being elected to Parliament. So what he did was this. He had all of his Lord Lieutenants to go down to the very counties and to summon all the important officials in each county and ask them three questions. And these are the three questions of James II. And it all depended upon your answer to these questions as whether you would get the support of the crown and hopefully of the local people. And here were the three questions that James had his lieutenants ask these local leaders. First of all, ask them, if they were elected to Parliament, would they favor the repeal of the Test Acts? Now remember what the Test Acts were. That was the law of Parliament that said that you had to be an Anglican to be elected to office. You could not be a Roman Catholic. Or a Presbyterian, or a nonconformist, but the main thing is Roman Catholic. The Test Acts kept the Roman Catholics out of Parliament. So the first question of James II was, ask them, if they were elected to Parliament, would they try to repeal the Test Acts? And of course, if they said no, well, he wouldn't give them their support. Second, ask them if they would assist in the election of members to Parliament who were pledged to repeal the Test Acts. And if anybody said yes, we would elect somebody to office who would repeal the Test Acts, meaning it'd be possible for a Roman Catholic to come to office, they would receive the king's support. If they said no, we're not going to work for the repeal of those acts, they'd come under the king's displeasure. And it's a terrible thing to come under the displeasure of a tyrant. And then there was a third question he asked. Would you actively support the king's declaration of indulgence? Now, the king's declaration of his indulgence was his decree that Roman Catholic worship was legal now, even though it was still illegal. It was his decree that it was legal now. Would you support the king? If they said yes, they'd have his favor. If they said no, his disfavor. Now, what happened as a result of this little attempt to control local politics? Most of the lords refused to ask the questions to anybody. In many counties, the local gentry, the local landowners, the local influential people wouldn't even show up for the meetings. And wherever those three questions were put, the answer showed that the vast majority of the local leaders throughout England did not approve of the program of James II. And it was the response to these three questions that proved that most of the gentlemen, most of the power brokers of England, were by this time solidly against the king. But there were two straws that broke the camel's back that led to his ousting. One was the trial of the seven bishops. The king, remember, had a declaration of indulgence. And by simple decree, he said, in effect, among other things, Roman Catholics now have freedom of worship in this land. When he did that, the archbishop himself and six other bishops petitioned him to withdraw that decree because it was illegal and against the laws of the land. James, in blind fanaticism, said that they were in rebellion against the king and had all the seven bishops placed in prison in the Tower of London to await prosecution for libel and slander against the king. It is interesting, by the way, that while this archbishop and these six bishops of the Church of England were suffering in the Tower, it was the leading nonconformists that came to visit them in prison to give them consolation and comfort. Now, who were the nonconformists? They were the preachers that these very bishops and archbishops had ejected from their pulpits because they were Calvinists and Presbyterians. Well, what was the second thing? Now, the people didn't take lightly to putting seven bishops in jail. What was the second straw that broke the camel's back? The birth of a son. His first wife had died. He had two Protestant daughters. His second wife was a Roman Catholic. And just before the trial of the seven bishops, James II became the father of a son by a Roman Catholic wife. And that scared the Protestants to death because there was the next king of England. And they envisioned an unending Roman Catholic dynasty through this young boy. And so the Whigs and the Tories, the Whigs who were critical of the king and wanted a representative government, the Tories who were supportive of the king, joined together in a secret alliance and wrote a letter and sent it to Holland, June the 30th, 1688, and ask William of Orange to come and deliver them, deliver England from the tyranny of James II. I'll tell you a little interesting story about James's second wife and this Roman Catholic boy born during the trial of the seven bishops, when his credibility and favorables were at an all-time low. Her name was Mary of Modena. She had never given birth to a child who had survived. She had all of her pregnancies were difficult pregnancies. And it's very interesting, isn't it, that at this crucial time in James's career, Mary of Modena should give birth to a healthy male heir. Well, that was more than the Protestants could take. And so a story was spread around, and most people believed it. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but since he was a steward, who knows? The story was instantly spread that this child, James Edward Francis Stuart, was not the son of Mary and of James, but was the son of a washerwoman by the name of Mary Gray, who had slipped the baby into the queen's bed in a warming pan for her feet. It's difficult to tell how many people believe that, but throughout that child's life, all up into adulthood, he was called by his enemies as the old pretender. And in the 1740s, early 1700s, staged an uprising, which we'll get to at another time, against the throne, claiming to be the true heir, the old pretender. He was put down, and then his son, Prince Charlie, was the young pretender. And he tried to get the throne and failed. But that's another great story, and we'll get to that. Whatever may have been the private opinion of William of Orange concerning who this boy was, his wife Mary, who was James's daughter, was convinced that her father was trying to cheat her out of her birthright and out of her right to be the Queen of England in his death. Not only was James II himself debauched, but the public morals of the English people had become debauched. Christian principles were undermined because of the unblushing immorality, open immorality of Charles II, and most particularly of James II. Ignorance pervaded the whole mass of the English population, who were prepared for almost any form of religion the government chose to give them. It didn't matter. The dissenters, the great men, 2,000, you remember, were ejected from their pulpits because they wouldn't agree to the act of uniformity and bow before the Anglican bishops. They chose rather to suffer exile and homelessness and poverty in defense of Calvinism and the Reformed faith and Presbyterianism, rather to compromise and to kiss the ring, so to speak, in the feet of the bishops and archbishops of the Anglican Church. The dissenters were growing old, many of them physically weak and wasting because of persecution. Many of them had migrated to the New World, to North America. Those old dissenters, those old Calvinists that still remained, were crushed in their spirit. They were split in all kinds of congregational fragments without anything to hold them together. They were incapable of doing anything as far as common organization is concerned, and as a result, with their fragmentation, they were an easy conquest to the enemy. And that's why, beloved, you've got to understand, as we said and as we began this years ago on this study, if you have an Episcopal church where the final authority resides in one man, you will have political tyranny. I mean, it's a fact of history. That if there's a one-man rule in the church, there'll be a one-man rule in the state. That's why you remember James I, that great pervert, James I, had as his bumper sticker that he loved, that motto that he kept, go by no bishop, no king. You do away with the bishops, eventually going to come after me, so I'm for bishops. Because he understood, I got to have tyranny in the church in order to preserve tyranny in the state. What was the cry of the Presbyterians? We have a representative government. We don't believe in one-man rule. We don't believe in democratic rule. We believe in the rule of representatives elected by the people to administer the law of God. Wherever there is a representative church government that's strong in a culture, i.e. a Presbyterian church, it is impossible to have a tyranny. That can be shown and documented in history, as well as in the Bible. That if you have a strong representative government in the church, you will have a strong representative government in the state. What was the great weakness of the Cromwellian days? What's the two strengths of the Presbyterian system, the biblical system, in a church? One is representative government, where you elect elders to represent Christ and to administer His word. The second great element is a confederacy. That is, Presbyterian churches are bound together organizationally, that you don't have autonomous, separate, independent congregations unrelated to the others, but you have congregations who have power over themselves and who share power in a presbytery, so that there's organizational as well as doctrinal unity that holds them together. And it was on that basis, those two basic principles, that were formed into our Constitution, that it was Presbyterianism that's the genius of the U.S. Constitution. That they saw, our founding fathers in 1787 saw the representation of the Presbyterian Church and the confederation of the Presbyterian Church. It's not by accident. The first Constitution of the United States is called what? The Articles of Confederation. And they saw these two great elements of the Presbyterian Church and put them in the Constitution. Well, I've lost my train of thought here. So as long as you have a strong Presbyterian church, you can't have tyranny. What was the great weakness of the Cromwellian days? Cromwell wasn't a Presbyterian. Now, I don't say that in any kind of bigoted sense. I say that in the sense I've just explained. Cromwell was an independent. That is, he believed everything we believed about predestination and all that, and baptizing babies and all that, except that he believed that each congregation was independent and autonomous from the rest, and that there shouldn't be any kind of organizational bond holding them together. Well, what was the thing that eventually brought the Cromwellian Republic down? You remember? All of these various sects, S-E-C-T-S, all these various sects and groups, I mean, this whole great Puritan establishment just started crumbling. And this group had their own distinct little things, and that group, you had this group and that group, and there was nothing to hold them together. Each one of these little groups was separate, autonomous, independent from the rest, and as a result, with all of this bickering and faction fighting, there was nothing to hold the Commonwealth together, and so when the monarchy was presented to them, the enemies took advantage of this weakened position and replaced Cromwell with a tyrant. So that leads me to the second point. The third point. The first is Episcopal churches always lead to tyrannical governments. Presbyterian cultures always lead to representative free governments. Independent Congregationalist Baptist churches always lead to tyranny. It can be shown, it can be documented. That wherever you have had denominations or groups of churches where the congregations are independent and autonomous and separate from each other, and there's no real organizing factor, no common organization, no common confession of faith, the enemies always take advantage of that fragmentation. And that's exactly what happened with James II. That's why he came to the throne so easily, because of this fragmentation of a once great Puritan establishment. I recommend a book to you. If you have any problems with that, you want to read more on it, I recommend a very important book to you called The Failure of a Baptist Culture, a very important political and cultural book. So, because of the brokenness of the Puritan establishment, their conquest was easy. They were incapable of acting together. With the exception of a few Presbyterians, they all tamely licked the hand of the tyrant. Now listen, see if this doesn't sound familiar. They tamely, except for a few Presbyterians, and I mean that sincerely and historically, they tamely licked the hand of the tyrant, thankful for any little crumbs of freedom the king may throw at their feet, and totally careless about the ever-increasing encroachments of the tyrant that would soon dominate their lives and banish them and the gospel out of the land. In other words, they were the frogs in the pan of water. And the king was smart enough to give this indulgence, that indulgence, this little period of freedom, all the while he was turning up the heat in the pan. And the frog was just getting more and more used to the heat of the water until he found himself in boiling water. And that's the way many, most American Christians are today. As long as I have this little freedom, that little freedom, you throw me this little crumb, you do this little thing, let me have prayer in public schools, let me teach evolution in public schools, I'll be okay, everything will be wonderful. Lower my taxes, I'll be happy. Get the bad guys out of office that are really bad, I'll be happy. The whole time blind to the encroachment of tyranny upon our lives that will eventually lead to the enslavement of this culture. And if you talk to the average American today that, in these terms, saying there is encroaching tyranny that will eventually lead to your slavery and the arrest and persecution of Christians like me, they will look at you and think you are off the wall. That's exactly what these people thought about James II. And tens of thousands of them were brutally executed. Besides all this, if that wasn't enough, consider James's connections. James had a powerful ally in Louis XIV, one of the most powerful kings in the world. He was in full support of Louis XIV's extirpation, that is, seeking to expunge Protestantism and crush Protestantism in France. James II heartily applauded that. James II depended upon Louis XIV's assistance and the various other papal states and Roman Catholic nations to give him support. He could already boast that he had reduced Ireland to the Pope's authority. And with all these things in mind, England's deliverance from the tyranny, the bigotry, the Roman Catholicism of James must have appeared to most people as something just short of a miracle. I mean, how with tyranny this firmly rooted, a powerful navy, powerful ally in Louis XIV, the opposition crushed and shattered, to think that in one simple stroke, all of a sudden, literally, all of a sudden, all of that would come crashing down, is just short of a miracle. And it's even a more amazing act of God's providence when you realize how it all came crashing down. And how England was in one stroke delivered from the tyranny of a Stuart and the bigotry and tyranny of the Pope. Now here's how God did it. He used the fanaticism of one man, James II, to make everybody sick and tired of his tyranny and bigotry. He used the fanaticism of one man. He used the intervention of another man who was a prince in the smallest country in Europe, Holland, and only part of Holland at that. He accomplished the deliverance of England from tyranny and Roman Catholicism in spite of the fact that there was the most powerful alliance of enemies from all over the world, who all of a sudden, mysteriously, seemed to be smitten at the critical hour with paralysis. Louis XIV was dedicated to the expunging of Calvinism and Protestantism, and he did nothing about the invasion of William III, William of Orange. He did absolutely nothing. It's like they were all paralyzed. And finally, it was the Anglican Church that had always been the bosom friend of despotism that led the way to England's deliverance by leaders of that church who shrank away in dismay after the deliverance was accomplished. I mean, the glorious revolution of 1688 is one of the most amazing acts of God's providence in all of human history. We're going to talk more about it next week, but let's get rid of James II first real quick. James has the trial of the seven bishops. Nobody liked that. James has a son, the old pretender. That scared the Protestants. There was one man that could come and deliver them if he would. And their choice of a Dutch Presbyterian, the Anglicans' choice. Now remember, it was the Anglicans who were in control, not the Presbyterians. The Anglican church and the English people, the English leaders, chose a Dutch Presbyterian named William of Orange to come and rescue them from the Stuarts. Oh, that was shrewd. Let me tell you who William of Orange was. You know what William of Orange, this Dutchman's mother's name was? Mary Stuart. You know who Mary Stuart was? The daughter of Charles I. William had a wife. You know who his wife, what his wife's name was? Mary Stuart, the daughter of James II. He was the grandson of Charles I, whom Cromwell executed. His daughter was the his wife was the daughter of James II. And Louis XIV, the powerful Sun King, at this time was in trouble because there was a great amount of unfavorables with reference to him because of his treatment of the French Huguenots. And because of God's providence blinding him, he found out about William's decision to invade England, but he didn't do anything about it, even though he knew that William was a Dutch Calvinist, because he thought that James II could handle him, and in the process it would distract James II, and England would be involved in a civil war, and he would still prosper, Louis XIV. That was one of the greatest miscalculations of his whole career. So William and Mary come to England and rescue the English people from tyranny. Now, this is 1689. You remember John Knox? Remember John Knox died in the 1500s, a century earlier? You remember John Knox's view of politics, this great Scotch Calvinist? Remember he said that politics is to be covenantal, federal, and the word federal comes from a Latin word for covenant, that it should be that politics, that civil institutions are based on a series of covenants where the king covenants with God to be his faithful servant and the king covenants with the people to faithfully protect them in terms of biblical law. And when the people covenant with the king to be his faithful and submissive servants as long as he is faithful to the covenants he made with God, and in the faith of the covenant the people make with God to be their faithful people. He said that any kind of just and free and orderly society is based on those covenants. That's what John Knox preached a century before. Well, the Presbyterians are out of the picture. Knox has been dead for a century. The Anglicans are in control. I want to show you the providence of God. Some way or another, Parliament had to get rid of James II before they could ask William to be the king. So Parliament met, and the House of Commons voted, and later the House of Lords acquiesced. The House of Commons voted, this is made up of Royalists and Anglicans mostly, because the dissenters, the good guys, were not allowed to hold political office. So these were Royalists and Anglicans, not the followers of John Knox, at least self-consciously. So the House of Commons voted on January the 22nd, 1689, that King James, quote, had endeavored to subvert the Constitution by breaking the original contract between king and people, and therefore had abdicated the throne. Shades of John Knox. They said, he has subverted the Constitution by breaking the original covenant between king and people. And the Parliament also resolved that it, quote, was inconsistent with the safety and welfare of this Protestant kingdom to be governed by a popish prince, unquote. How in the world did that happen? Makes you want to believe in the sovereignty of God, doesn't it? Let us pray. Father, we thank you that your word has proven true, that the heart of the king is like a channel of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will. I thank you that parliaments and congressmen, kings and presidents are under your sovereign control. I thank you for the Commonwealth of Cromwell. I thank you for the glorious revolution of 1688 that continued what Cromwell began. Lord, bless us to live faithfully before this cloud of witnesses that has gone on before us, confident that in your providence you will cause all things to work together for good to them that love you. For Christ's sake, amen.